supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Lehigh County District Attorney Jim Martin announced criminal charges against a Roman Catholic priest this afternoon at a news conference in Allentown. The charges come 1 week after the Pennsylvania Attorney General released a scathing grand jury report into the alleged widespread sexual abuse of children and systematic cover-up in six of the state's eight dioceses. The Lehigh County District Attorney says the charges are not related to the grand jury report. Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarski joins me from Allentown. And Lindsay, what can you tell us about these charges?
Hi, Dave. So Father Kevin Lonergan of Pottsville, he's been charged with corruption of a minor and indecent assault. About a year ago, while he was a priest at St. Francis of Assisi in Allentown, it's alleged that Lonergan met the 17-year-old victim before Mass, and he got her cell phone number from another church member. That led to inappropriate text messages and Snapchats, including nude photos that Lonergan reportedly sent to the victim. Then in February, it's alleged that he inappropriately hugged and groped the girl at church.
Lindsay, what's known about when and how these charges came to light?
So the allegations against Lonergan first surfaced in early June and were brought to the DA's attention from attorneys at the Allentown Diocese. So that would have been too late to be included in the statewide investigation that we've been hearing so much about this week. Here's District Attorney Jim Martin.
Jane Doe had held it to herself for several months. She courageously came forward, reported it to the priest at Central Catholic, who immediately reported it to the diocese. It was thereafter brought to my attention by, as I said, the attorneys for the diocese.
Lindsay, what's been the response from the Allentown Diocese on the charges?
So the Allentown Diocese moved Lonergan from ministry shortly after they heard about the allegations. They say they wanted to go public earlier with this information, but they were told by the DA's office that an announcement would interfere with their investigation at the time. At this time, Lonergan's bail has been set at $50,000, and he's since been released from the Lehigh County Jail.
Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarski on NewsWorks Tonight. Compared to many major cities, Philadelphia is an affordable place to rent an apartment, with one big exception. There's a real shortage of units that are affordable for those who live below the poverty line, and Philadelphia is the poorest big city in America. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, a new study shows people paying with housing choice vouchers have a particularly hard time.
Researchers at the Urban Institute found that nearly 70% of Philly landlords with eligible apartments said they did not accept housing choice vouchers, a rent subsidy offered through the federal government. Mary Cunningham is a senior fellow with the Institute.
These are landlords who have apartments listed for rent, and they meet the rental cap for the program, so the voucher is worth the rent that the landlord is looking for.
It's not illegal to deny housing choice vouchers, but Cunningham says it works against a big goal of the program, to give low-income families the chance to live in neighborhoods with more economic opportunity.
We have to change the program to make it work better for families.
The study doesn't dive into why landlords denied people with housing choice vouchers, but Jim Sims has a hunch. He was a landlord in Philly for 3 decades before getting out of the game last year. He says renting to someone with a housing choice voucher was often a real headache, not because the people were bad tenants, but because it took so long to get them into a unit.
The whole process can take anywhere from 2.5 to, let's say, 3.5 months without receiving any rent, just to get a PHA tenant.
Before someone with a housing voucher can move in, the Philadelphia Housing Authority has to inspect the place and determine the rent, which can spark a lengthy debate with the landlord. Setting up a time to sign the lease also prolongs the process. Still, Sim says he always accepted vouchers. He knew what it was like to struggle with housing. When he was 10, the bank seized his childhood home after his dad was injured on the job and his family couldn't pay the mortgage.
For a while, we lived with relatives. The family had to split up.
To encourage more landlords in low-poverty neighborhoods to accept vouchers, Cunningham says cities like Philly should consider giving them signing bonuses and other financial incentives like paying for security deposits or waiving fees. Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
As the opioid crisis continues, a debate has emerged between operators who run drug recovery houses. Should those battling addictions be able to use medication-assisted treatment during their stay, including methadone or Suboxone? As Keystone Crossroads contributor Nina Feldman reports, some recovery houses demand cold turkey sobriety, while others worry that approach is pushing more users into homelessness.
Christina Ravel is 22, and she's been in and out of rehab for the past 5 years. The most recent time, her doctor prescribed her Suboxone, a low-dose opioid that curbs cravings and prevents withdrawal.
People think, like, that you feel something or you're, like, high, but when I take it, I just feel normal. I don't have my cravings.
Ravel said she knew she needed to stay on Suboxone to get her life back together. And she knew she wanted to be in a recovery house where she could live with other women, go to NA meetings, and get therapy.
When you're by yourself, you kind of feel lonely. It's easy to say to yourself, well, one day I'm just not going to take it and I'm going to get high for one day.
So with her time in rehab running out, Ravel started calling around to see who would take her. But it wasn't looking good. Treatments like Suboxone are controversial to some recovery house owners.
I would say right off the bat, like, Christina, I'm on Suboxone. I'm just looking for an open bed. And they're like, we don't take people on Suboxone. Just hang up on me. That was for a couple days, and I was, like, really upset. Like, I was like, if I don't find a place, like, I don't want to be homeless, you know?
Eventually, she found an unexpected ally.
Hi, welcome. I'm Barb Williamson. This is
Barb Williamson has been running recovery houses in southeastern Pennsylvania since 2014. She opened her first one when she was 25, after being sober herself for just a year. And back then, she did not allow people on Suboxone or methadone to live in her houses. In the recovery world, that's known as MAT, medication-assisted treatment. She didn't even consider it.
I just felt like, you know, I tried heroin when I was 15 years old. I quickly was doing it every single day. I ended up homeless in the streets. I was 98 pounds and willing to do anything for my next fix. And I just thought, if someone like me could get sober, why couldn't someone like you without medication? So I was just really against it.
And then one day, last November, Williamson was struck by a post from a community activist she knew on social media.
A woman named Brooke Feldman, you know, made a Facebook post about recovery houses not doing enough because we weren't welcoming people in MAT, which was making the people homeless and then using again. And, you know, she was pretty harsh and just saying we were a part of the problem.
Brooke Feldman remembers that, too.
I just decided to take a little bit more of a confrontational approach because at the rate that people are dying, you know, at some point this has to become unacceptable.
Williamson took the post really personally. So she set out to do some research and prove Feldman wrong. She took a couple trainings, talked to a lot of doctors, and began to change her mind.
You know, I've had residents that have left my houses and overdosed and died. That's what it came down to. What do I have to do to not have morgues calling parents of 18, 19, and 20-year-old kids? It's anything. I will do anything. So if the doctors and the facts are saying that MAT helps that, I will do my part to facilitate that need.
Williamson opened her first house for residents on MAT about 5 months ago in Delaware County. She's since opened three more in the area, three for men and one for women in all. But the idea is still uncommon. Statewide, Fred Way of the Pennsylvania Recovery Residents Association estimates that out of the 200 homes he certifies, about 7 will take people on MAT, even though those treatments are considered the standard of care for opioid addiction. Way says, in part, that's because a lot of recovery houses are closely aligned with 12-step programs, many of which count MAT as a violation of their abstinence-only rules.
I guess in this new millennial world, okay, especially the new ones, are more apt to go with MAT. The old school recovery house operators, you know, the ones that came up with, you know, you had to use a toothbrush, you know, to clean the floor. And, you know, the hard line, they're really hard to change, you know, because they see MAT as an individual still using.
But clinicians like Renee Calhoun say MAT saves lives. Calhoun runs a clinic that offers methadone treatment and therapy in Bucks County. She said the housing options for her patients are slim, and without a place to live, treatments like methadone or Suboxone are less likely to work.
They don't have access to clean air, clean water, or food. You know, how can our folks ever get to where they need to get?
Williamson's new houses aren't the only sign that the tide is starting to change. Earlier this year, the city of Philadelphia began requiring that all the recovery houses it funds start accepting people on MAT. The National Association of Recovery Residences is preparing a policy guide to educate recovery houses how best to offer it. After Williamson opened her first house, she wrote a message to Brooke Feldman, the woman who got her thinking about all this in the first place.
I introduced myself because she had no idea who I was. I explained how I hated her guts and she consumed me.
She was really clear that she was upset with me and that, you know, she was not a fan, but that recovery had taught her to be willing to kind of take a look, you know, at herself, and that, you know, what started off as an attempt to kind of prove me wrong, you know, ended up being sort of an enlightening experience for her.
I thanked her for pushing me in the right direction to open my mind and, you know, help more people. So I always give credit where credit's due.
Nina Feldman for Keystone Crossroads.
The dream to complete a trail network connecting the urban, suburban, and rural communities of the Philadelphia region is still a dream. But a new analysis of the 750-mile-long so-called Circuit Trails helps to prioritize next steps. Let's take a spin with Leonard Benarek, regional planner with the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. Leonard, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
So talk about the genesis of the idea of having this extensive circuit trail.
This was a concept that was largely made up in 2012 by a group of people who said, well, we have these, everybody has their own trail. This county, this city has a trail, but we want to create a network where they're all interconnected across municipal, county, and even state boundaries into a single cohesive network. The idea of this really large network, at the time it was 750 miles, we've since grown it to 811 planned or built miles, is something that is going to, when completed, have a really revolutionary impact on our transportation network. This is not a network that's designed to be only used for recreational use, but it's designed to be able to be used for people to get from point A to point B and not have to use a car.
So who are the various partners who are joining Bicycle Coalition in making this dream a reality?
So we're a signatory member of the Circuit Coalition, which is a 65-plus member organization of other nonprofits. We all work together and then sort of pick our circuit trails projects that we're trying to get built, because currently only 325 miles of the network are built. And the remainder, roughly two-thirds of the network, are either in construction or planned or in construction in the pipeline, which is like getting moving towards that phase. But it's essentially some of these trails are nothing more than an idea in someone's mind that has been put onto paper.
Let's talk about this new study that prioritizes where to go next.
Our boss, Sarah Clark Stewart, our executive director, she came into the office one day. She said, what if we had a top 10 list of the trails that really need to move forward? What would go into that list? How would we quantify it to see, in some senses, should we be doing anything differently? How are we doing? How are our priorities doing? And so we worked with our intern, Kyle Hearing, who helped us develop an objective way to really quantify with a numeric value which trails have the capacity to have the most impact on the type of folks who need it the most. So building a trail in a really low-density part of the suburbs where everyone has access to a car might not be the best way to spend transportation dollars. But building it in a community that's very dense, on an environmentally degraded area where there's a lot of dumping, and where there are high numbers of people who suffer from what the DVRPC calls an indicator of potential disadvantage, that's things that go from, are you from a minority community? Is this a single-parent household? Are you transportation constrained? Do you not have access to a car? So this uses census data to then put a numeric value on whether or not people in that census tract have a potential to be disadvantaged. Doesn't mean that you are. Means that it's more likely in this area than another area. So we looked at the segments of the circuit that are currently in the pipeline, which means they're the ones that are the most ready to go. And we looked at the communities that they're passing through using this information from the DVRPC. That's the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission. That's our municipal planning organization. And we were able to come up with a score that gave certain trails, you know, higher and lower scores based on, you know, are we doing the right thing?
What are some of the top priority places to go next?
It wasn't surprising that the majority of the trail segments that we saw popping, like rising to the top, were in Philadelphia, were in eastern Delaware County, and were in and around Trenton, New Jersey, and Camden, New Jersey. So these are some of the areas that anyone can tell you are some of the lower income parts of our area. For example, I think it was item number 3. It's the 36th Avenue to Euclid Avenue and the Merchantville Path.
Where's that?
This is in Camden County, New Jersey. So it's just outside of Camden City. And essentially, this is a very, very short segment. It's a bridge that goes over Route 130. And Route 130, some people call New Jersey's Highway of Death. It's every bit as deadly as Roosevelt Boulevard. Actually, a pedestrian was just killed yesterday or this morning trying to cross Route 130. This is a very dangerous area. So there's an existing bridge. The rehab of the bridge will be very expensive, and it's a very, very short segment. So this tiny little segment is going to cost, you know, X number of millions of dollars to build. So the priority goes elsewhere. But our analysis showed that this segment is number 3 in our entire 9-county region in terms of its ability to impact people of lower incomes and impact the most people and give them the most connectivity. So it's not just a short segment, but a short segment that is connected to a built part of the Circuit Trail network already. So this gives our advocates an advocacy tool to say, actually, you're getting a lot of bang for your buck out of this very short segment because of the number of people that are able to get mobility by getting this very short segment done. So it actually is worth XYZ number of millions of dollars to build. And that's the sort of shift we're trying to get here, is not necessarily to say, where can we pave the most miles for the least amount of dollars, but how can we connect the most people to cycling infrastructure for the fewest amount of dollars.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Leonard Benaric, regional planner with the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the Marian Anderson Award, a Philadelphia honor given to an artist for excellence and public service. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that in November, it will be given to Queen Latifah.
The recipient of this year's Marian Anderson Award will be Queen Latifah.
Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney made the announcement at the Sofitel Hotel downtown.
Her efforts have focused on empowering women and providing scholarships to students in need. Queen Latifah is an excellent role model and clearly a well-deserving recipient of this prestigious honor. Ladies first, ladies
first. Queen Latifah, aka Dana Owens of East Orange, New Jersey, exploded on the hip-hop scene with her 1989 album All Hail the Queen and its first single, Ladies First. She has since become a popular actress on television and film, winning many awards, including a Golden Globe and 3 BET Awards. For 20 years, the Marian Anderson Award has recognized popular artists who have given back to society. Latifah has been a prominent supporter of black female artists. Her production company, Flavor Unit, recently partnered with Essence Ventures to financially support film and television projects by black artists. Tiffany Tavares of Wells Fargo Bank, a sponsor of the award, said Latifah embodies the legacy of Marian Anderson.
This remarkable artist is facilitating the systemic change that allows women of color to control and create their own narrative. That is something that Marian Anderson dedicated her life to.
The Marian Anderson Award is named after the Philadelphia-born opera singer who broke down racial barriers in the classical music field. Queen Latifah will attend the award gala and concert on November 20th at the Kimmel Center. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. SEPTA is again looking to extend its Norristown high-speed line further into the suburbs. After the transit agency abandoned its idea of linking the line to King of Prussia, officials in Phoenixville now say they want to be connected. We'll have that story on tomorrow's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.